You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
And now here's Rod Adams and Shane Brown with The Atomic Show.
It's atomic. It's atomic.
It is time for Atomic Show number 44. This is Rod Adams coming to you from Annapolis, Maryland.
And this is Shane Brown coming to you from Las Lunas, New Mexico. And I suppose you said that earlier that you wanted to get started tonight with a New York Times article. I found it this morning, and I think you may have seen it independently.
Nope, I didn't see it independently. I appreciated you sending it to me because it really is an important article that has some important concepts in it. But why don't you go ahead and introduce it since you found it.
Okay, so in the New York Times RSS feed this morning, there is a article called Paying in Pollution for Energy Hunger, and it covers the extreme popularity of Chinese-manufactured diesel generators in India and South Asia, and the fact that entire industries are able to spring up where, for instance, there's a section in the article where they talk about a guy who's now making a living repairing televisions, and he has more business than he knows what to do with, and basically it's rural electrification, but with diesel generators, so it's causing an enormous amount of pollution, and there's not really anything they can currently do about it other than perhaps look at biomass, but in some ways biomass is even worse than diesel. And then, of course, there are a few places in the article where they pipe up with, well, there many of these countries are very mountainous and they have small-scale hydro that could be developed, or many of these same countries are also very sunny, so you could make a case for photovoltaic and battery backup systems, but all of those, as we've talked about before, are incredibly expensive and not really something that they can repair on site, whereas at least diesel generators are ubiquitous and extremely reliable for whatever other flaws that they have, which is what most of the article's about.
And, in fact, diesel generators are a very understandable technology for someone with even minimal education. They're very simple devices that, as we always say, work fine, lasts a long time, as long as you don't hurt them by burning the wrong kind of fuels.
And, right.
It did talk about, in some cases, people are hazarding the longevity of their diesel generators by mixing the fuel with kerosene,
yep.
Which is far cheaper and sold on a subsidized basis in many developing countries. It's always been subsidized in the past because kerosene was the source of cooking fuel for a lot of places in the remote areas. And the countries decided it was better to subsidize kerosene than to have the villagers deforest the whole countryside.
Looking for alternative fuels. Yeah, that's kerosene reduces the lubricating properties of diesel fuel and reduces their lives that way. Is that the mechanism?
Yes. But, of course, like you said, these diesel generators are coming out of China and are probably very low cost on a per kilowatt capacity basis.
Right. So, basically, it's kind of like a two-edged sword. I mean, on the one hand, there are whole villages that are coming to life at night. And they actually mentioned in the article that they're able to run televisions and lights for children to read by where before, when the lights went out, that was it. And you could try to make do with a candle or a torch, but nothing beats electric light when you're trying to learn.
Of course, I can hear the calls now from those people who say that this has got to be a tragedy for these rural, quote, pristine areas to have the contamination of television coming in. But, I mean, I think it's a wonderful thing to have the ability for people to make their own choices and to get exposure to what the world is like and to have the opportunities, like you said, to turn on a light bulb and read a book.
Yep, without having to go through an enormous amount of trouble. And this really brings it back to the whole idea of what small-scale nuclear generators would be about, because this is exactly the same market, isn't it?
It is. And of course, one of the things the article doesn't really mention is that these diesel generators are okay for areas where the fuel is subsidized or where they're using the diesel generators to power small-scale stuff, electric light bulbs or whatnot, but that if the prosperity of the area starts to grow and people start to think about things like refrigerators and climate control devices and manufacturing technologies, the cost of the electricity from a diesel power generator is going to be dependent upon the world price of oil. And a lot of times when I talk about, you know, or I advocate nuclear energy as a way to reduce the world's dependence on oil, you know, the immediate response from people who are against nuclear power is, well, oil and nuclear power have little to do with each other. But obviously in this case, these people are burning oil to create electricity.
And this is just one area of the world where diesel generators are used to produce power. And there are many, many communities in northern Canada and Alaska whose entire power supply is entirely dependent upon barged in, shipped in large quantities of diesel fuel.
Right. I think we've talked in the past a little bit about the village in Alaska, Galena, which has, you know, been in the news, and many other people have heard about it, that is in negotiations with Toshiba for a 10 megawatt electric atomic generator, which again just shows kind of where the market might be. That small village stores about 3 million gallons of diesel fuel over the during the summertime, so they can burn it all winter long. Of course, in this article, one of the things that's pretty obvious to me is that the villages that are getting this electrification via oil obviously are close enough to the transportation infrastructure to get the oil delivered.
And I wonder how much of that transportation infrastructure is basically people carrying barrels of it by hand or on bicycles, because a lot of things in that part of the world are carried with a lot of manual labor behind them, because the transportation infrastructure just isn't there.
Right.
Or is still developing.
Here's another opportunity for us to do a quick calculation on the air. If I remember the number correctly, it takes a gallon of diesel fuel to create, I think, 20 kilowatt hours of electricity.
What's the specific gravity of diesel?
Okay, I can't tell that one off the top of my head.
It floats on water, and I know that gasoline is 0.7, which means that's 700 kilos per cubic meter. Whereas water is the standard against which specific gravity is measured. So if we assume that
diesel is just a little bit heavier than gas.
Yeah, so if we call it 0.8, that means that a gallon, which is 3.785 liters, so 3.785, that's liters, That would be kilograms of water. Now, if we multiply that by 0.8, that is 3 kilograms of diesel fuel in a gallon of volume. Now, a kilogram of diesel is something like, let's say, 50 megajoules per kilo, since gasoline is about 44 and diesel is about 10% more energy. So if we multiply that by 50, that's 150 megajoules per kilo, or 150 megajoules per gallon. Those of you who are cringing at my mixing units. But I try to think in metric as often as possible. So, and of course, reactor power is measured in kilowatts per foot, right? So we are no strangers to mixed units here. So 150. So what was the number that you were trying to back out?
No, I'm pretty sure that it takes about 1 gallon, 1 U.S. gallon, to create 20 kilowatt hours of electricity.
So 20 kilowatt hours is 72 million joules. 72 million joules is roughly half of this 150 megajoules, and if you assume a 50% efficiency, which diesel can probably get up to once you bring in all the others, that sounds ballpark average. Yeah. So that 20 kilowatt hours is about right, because this 150 megajoules per gallon is equivalent to about 40 kilowatt hours per gallon.
Right. So if diesel delivered to a village cost $3 per gallon, that's 15 cents per kilowatt hour. If it costs $4 per gallon, then you're talking about 20 cents per kilowatt hour. So that's, you know, not terribly cheap power.
That's about the same as what Long Island customers have been paying for the last 20 years since Shoreham was shut down.
Yeah, but I think people on Long Island have a few more resources than people in a small village in India. So anyway, the point is that as the article goes on, it talks about, well, you know, the only way to really tackle the pollution and noise from the diesel generators is to start talking about the rural electrification that is more like what we've had in the U.S., where you have power plants that then send the power out via transmission lines, and you kind of centralize the power production so that you can use better pollution controls and better distribution of fuels or whatever, or so that you can put in about a 10-megawatt Adams engine and create your power without any noise or atmospheric emissions at all.
And now, would that be delivering...
I guess my wife got it. Very good. All right. In fact, I am, you know, podcasting in my stockings and in my home office, so occasionally the telephone will ring in the background.
People have a tendency to co-locate telephones and computers together in the same room for some reason.
There's a good reason for that. I spend a lot of time sitting on my derriere in front of the computer screen, so I'd like to be able to reach the telephone. I'm a lazy kind of guy. Of course,
laziness is good.
I have to admit that I just spent a delightful hour and a half watching a keynote address. Those of you who know me know that I'm kind of an Apple fanatic and have been since about 1987, and am absolutely enthralled by the new iPhone that Apple announced today.
I saw some information about that today. I missed the keynote and went and looked up some information about that, and that looks like it's going to give the Finnish and the Japanese companies a good run for their money on the mobile phone.
Oh, man.
Combined personal electronics market.
I looked at that thing and my wife said, Rod, I need a new phone. And, of course, she has been, you know, very nicely kind of, you know, making good with a phone that's got a little broken hinge and all that stuff, so... I guess maybe for our anniversary, which is at the end of May, I'll be able to buy her a new phone. I think the device will be available in the U.S. in June, which is kind of unusual for Apple to announce something.
Yeah, it's usually when Steve Jobs mentions something, it's available on the Apple Store at that moment so that the deluge can begin.
Well, it's interesting. The reason why he said he announced it before it was actually being sold, and that has to do with regulators. When you introduce a phone, you have to get permission from the FCC and get FCC approval, which is a public process.
Right.
So as he said, he would prefer to announce it himself rather than have the FCC announce it. So I guess it's kind of similar to what we're going to end up having to do when we start doing our applications to the NRC for the Adams engine. We're going to have to tell everybody as much as we want to about what the machine's going to do, because as soon as we start our application, it's going to be a completely public process anyway.
It's kind of interesting in how the NRC's and FCC's rules work and how things are going with some of the small spaceflight companies. You may have heard last week that Jeff Bezos of Amazon lifted the veil on what Blue Origin has been doing. Blue Origin is his private spaceflight company that's been developing towards eventually flying tourists on suborbital flights. And talk about a company with a cone of silence. And no one at the company seems to speak in public that they are employees of the company.
That's an interesting way to do things.
I mean, we're talking totally black. Other than speculation on websites and what the company was required to release to the FAA for an environmental assessment for their West Texas testing site, which is incidentally is about 120 miles from anywhere. It's out in the middle of the desert, and really? It's about 12 miles from the nearest public road. So,
what part of Texas is it? I mean,
it's about 30 miles north of Van Horn, which is about 120 miles straight line distance from El Paso.
Okay, so definitely
it's up in the mountains,
in the moonscape. I mean, I remember the area out in that section of western Texas. It's, yep. It is like driving through nothingness.
Yep, although at least there's hills there as opposed to some other parts of drives I can think of. But yeah. Anyway, we were talking about Adams engines and getting back on topic, sorry.
That's not a problem. I actually, you know, one of the things that I want to make sure people understand about, you know, some of the motivation that we've had in developing our design is that we really want to hold true to our initial tagline, which is nuclear power for the rest of us, which means designing nuclear plants that are not large central station power plants, but that can be put into areas like the small villages in India or small villages in Alaska or island nations or whatever, where certainly the people there are just like the rest of us. We all like to have electrical power. Electrical power is a tremendously freeing product. It's one that, I mean, I'm sitting in my desk and looking at all of the various electrical devices I have in my office, and then of course I go into my kitchen and recognize just how many things that we have that make life simply more comfortable or easier. You know, dishwashers and electric stoves and washing machines and you know, thinking about all the people who still have to do much of that work by hand. We're thinking about many of the people, often women, who have to spend a good portion of their days simply collecting the fuel that will allow them to cook their family's meal. Cooking, yep, is necessary, of course, because if they don't cook it, they generally will poison their family with all the disease-ridden stuff that might be in the water or whatever.
Yep. There is a direct correlation between energy consumption and life expectancy / birth rate / longevity. And conservation for simple reasons of being financially responsible and not going and burning as much power as you possibly can is good, but it's not going to get you there. And more conservative estimates that I've seen in the last couple of years from several books have put the amount of power that has to come online between now and the middle of the century, 43 years away, 2050, to be about 8 times the current power requirements that we currently have in capacity.
Wow. There's not many sources that can even come close to doing that kind of growth.
And that's assuming that, that's not assuming that we bring everybody in the world up to American standard of living. That merely assumes that we try to enlarge the prospects for the developing countries to have access to energy while maintaining our own and doing everything else that we need to do with it. I mean, if we wanted to go to an American standard of living, it'd be more like 11 to 15 times.
Well, I'm not certain that I advocate a typical American standard of living, although I'm not trying to be, look at how good I am or whatever, but for various reasons, you know, like the fact that I'm a lazy cheapskate, I drive a small diesel-powered automobile that gets about 47 miles to the gallon. And in recent months, I've found that there are 3 other people that happen to go this basically the same route that I go and at the same time. So there's 4 people in a carpool now. And we all drive small cars. One guy's got a Honda Civic, and then there's another older 4-seat small car. I can't remember what it is, a Gallant or something like that. And then we do have one guy who has a family, so he drives a minivan. But we figure we're getting, averaging about 150 miles to the gallon, 150 people miles per gallon,
right,
going back and forth to work. And not only does it, you know, save energy, but it is nicer to be able to doze off during the commute.
Oh, absolutely. And for myself, I vanpool almost every day to work, a round trip about 50 miles. So that's an average of between 8 and 14 people riding a large van that gets something like maybe 15 miles to the gallon. So we consume a few gallons, but we have many people that are being carried on those gallons.
Yeah, and that's a reasonable way to go. You know, a lot of people advocate mass transit. Mass transit only works if the tracks and the stations exist to go where you want to go. And in most places, or in many places, that infrastructure simply doesn't exist. And I say that even though I live in a place with the most subsidized mass transit in the whole country, and probably the nicest and best kept mass transit system, you know, the Washington Metro system. But it was designed as a ring system, which means if you want to go from a peripheral place to a peripheral place, you have to go through the city first. And it's not... I shouldn't say it's a spoke system, not a ring system, and it's hard to get across the city without making a few train changes and whatnot. So it just takes a long time. And anyway,
yeah.
Of course, the other thing about the Washington Metro system is it's operated. I think about 80% of its power comes from burning coal.
Coal by wire.
Well, it's not very long wires because I have to pass by 2 of the plants on my way to work.
Nice.
Yeah, the big old nasty. But there, of course, the good thing about the coal from the perspective of residents of Washington is that the plants are located off in those peripheral areas like Anacostia and whatnot. So, you know, the downtown residents don't have to see them. The people on Capitol Hill.
The power plants I'm familiar with in Mississippi, there are several several hybrid plants that can burn both natural gas and coal, depending upon cost. And I imagine that they've been burning coal since the natural gas spike started about 5 years ago, and most of the time. except when they happen to run out. And my grandfather on my wife's side, he happens to live in Pascagoula, and there is a power plant not too far from where his house used to be before Katrina that has a daily train car, a daily train delivery of 100-plus carloads of coal every day, because it is a full 1,000-megawatt power plant that supplies energy to most of that particular side of the Gulf Coast and exports a little bit into Alabama as well.
Oh, that's what it takes. It takes about 11,000 tons of coal a day, which the standard train car is about 120 tons per car. So it's essentially a 100 train car load of coal every day to fuel a 1,000-megawatt generator. The other piece of that, and this is a number that shocked Doug LaFollette, but it's the truth. When I talked to him on Good Day World, a coal-fired power plant that burns 11,000 tons of coal a day produces about 45,000 tons of CO2 every single day.
Yep.
And that's ignoring all the other nasty stuff like sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, and mercury that come out of the coal-fired power plant stack.
Among many, many, many other players.
Right. Well, the fly ash and that kind of stuff can be scrubbed. There are some atmosphere emissions controls that can be used to get the sulfur dioxide out of the gaseous emissions, but it has to go somewhere. Normally, where does sulfur dioxide go when you pull it out of the gas? It goes in the slurry pond. Sometimes sold, but
right. If it doesn't go into the atmosphere and then mix with water vapor and turn into acid rain and then make all kinds of, and I think I may have mentioned this to you, not only are we causing acid rain problems, have been doing so for decades to people in the Northeast, in the Adirondacks, near where I was born, not in Canada, but now China's coal growth has gotten so intense that we're starting to see acid rain in the West Coast, in meteorological monitoring stations in California and Oregon and Washington are starting to see sulfuric acid concentrations start to creep up.
Really? That's kind of scary.
It's coming directly across from the jet stream. The jet stream transports, given the distances involved, it transports pollutants from China to the west coast of the United States rather efficiently.
Well, that's something I've always said about, people say, well, Chernobyl showed that if you had a nuclear accident, it spreads the gases all over the world. And I say, well, what it shows to me is that all the gases that come out of power plants get spread around the world all the time. The only difference with Chernobyl's was it happened to be something that was easily measured.
Good. Provided a very efficient, although very poorly thought out, tracer.
Well, here's another, speaking of Chernobyl, let's move over to Europe. Something that's kind of going to surprise a lot of folks is that the European Commission is going to release a white paper probably tomorrow that talks about the future energy needs from Europe and implicitly is going to advocate a return of thinking to building new nuclear power plants.
Do you happen to know whether that white paper leverages the Extern-E results that you talked about with Mr. LaFollette?
It talks about, I think it references them in some other studies. Of course, the Extern-E study is very well done, but it's down, I guess it's been available for about 4 or 5 years now. But when people start looking at how does, organization of countries as large as the EU, which now imports, 50% of its energy fuels and looks like it's going to grow to about 65% of its energy fuels by 2030, how is it going to meet its Kyoto targets if it starts to do things like shutting down nuclear power plants in Germany and other places? You know, Sweden has talked about phasing theirs out, but fortunately they've been smart enough not to. But Germany's actually starting to shut down some of the older plants.
To which I can wish them well, but the arithmetic has been there in stark openness for decades.
Yeah, and, you know, some people that I've discussed with, you know, don't necessarily like to follow the second and third order subtleties in a discussion. I think that the owners of the nuclear plants in Europe, or in Germany particularly, have not raised too big of a stink because, you know, they have their plants, they're operating, they're producing good income. What they're kind of waiting for is when the plants are getting ready to be shut down, then they're going to start, you know, really pressing to keep them open for a little bit more time.
Yep.
And all of that. And what that does is it helps to inhibit the entry of new players into the marketplace.
Which is good for them.
Of course. Another piece that I am starting to see very clearly myself and have difficulty in trying to explain to others is that whenever you hear somebody fighting against something, you should follow the money just as quickly as you do if you hear somebody advocating for something, because you can make as much money by slowing down a competitor, and sometimes even more money, as you can by bringing in something new. People are very well tuned to the fact that if I go to somebody and say, hey, buy this new beer, they recognize that I'm probably selling beer. But what they don't seem to understand is if I try to go to them and say, man, you just don't want to drink beer, you just stay away from that beer stuff, what they don't recognize is that I might be a wine salesman, or I might be somebody who's selling hard liquor. You know, it's many of us, you know, people need to have, make a living, so, and companies need to sell their products.
Sure.
So,
I mean, this is advice that's been with us for millennia. It's called caveat emptor.
Buyer beware.
Buyer beware.
And it's pretty good. I'm not even a Latin guy.
So, that there's that one. There's also another one from the Blue Origin folks. The Blue Origin folks actually have a coat of arms that they came up with. It is the most awesome thing I've seen this week. And they have
send me a link to that.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and I'll send it to you. They also have a Latin motto, and it's gratitim ferociter. You know, step by step, boldly, or courageously, or ferociously, depending upon the flavor of Latin that you follow. And that describes their development schedule in the way that they're doing things. And they're building many, many development vehicles and learning from them step by step. And they're going to go out and try to break them individually, because this is the elderly, most efficient aerospace development that's ever been done. This is what was responsible for the SR-71, what was responsible for the Bell X-1 breaking the sound barrier, mm-hmm. all the way up through the space program, was engineers going out and testing X vehicles until they prang them and then learn the lessons and then go on and build the next vehicle.
You know, that's an interesting concept, because that's one of the things that has always frustrated me being a developer of an atomic power plant, is that I have been frustrated by the fact that there is no place and no means available today, like there was in the 50s, to tinker.
Yep.
You know, our avoidance of all possible accidents, incidents, whatever, makes it so that you can't simply find a place out in the middle of the Idaho desert, build a testing station, and build small reactors where you can afford to do the borax type experiment where you break.
Oh, those were awesome. Follow the bouncing reactor core. They actually, one of the borax reactor tests, they actually did a prompt criticality study, or prompt supercriticality, where they withdrew the control cruciform rods out the bottom of the reactor and caused all the water in the reactor to flash to steam from massively increased power. And it actually blew the reactor out the top of the pressure vessel, and it landed on its side some feet away.
Now
that's pranging a reactor.
Now, lest we make people nervous, what we we really know is, and what Adams Atomic Engines is planning to do, is we do believe that we have made a reactor that is safe enough and simple enough and low cost enough that once we build one, we should be able to test it to its full limits without breaking it, and that we should be able to let the reactor go through the transient and watch it and measure the reaction and watch that it does not cause any permanent damage to the core.
Well, sure, and that's partially due to the fuel form and partially due to the fact that there's going to be a lot of pressure to make those reactors built by turns like reactors that go to sea, and also by turns like reactors that are housed inside of essentially semi-mobile bank vaults.
Right. And one of the things that gives us confidence that we can build a reactor like this is the fact that very similar designs, the AVR and the Chinese HTR-10, have actually done the testing and done things like shutting off all coolant flow without scramming the reactor.
Incidentally, there was
pressure down to zero without scramming the reactor.
I was looking through the April 1990 issue of Popular Science. I think that's the first place I learned about the pebble bed reactor concept. And in that article, that was in that particular issue, they said that there was a televised test of that test up to full power and then shut off the coolant, where they actually televised the test and then ran the test footage on West German television sometime in the 70s. But that was the only article I ever saw that referenced that, and I think that was an awesome idea. I mean, these tests should be something that you see in TV commercials. This particular day, we're going to try to do this, that, or the other incredibly unkind thing to this particular reactor and watch what happens as we whack on this inert lump of metal as hard as we can, and basically it just creaks over onto its side and stops producing power, but it doesn't do anything other than continue to remain roughly rectangular shaped.
Right. And part of our goal is to do those kinds of tests, to do the televised test, and to put our audience to sleep because of the extreme boringness of those tests. In other words, we don't want our reactor operations to be exciting. You know, we're not trying to go to Mars or anything. We're simply trying to produce electricity.
And that is a fundamental difference between the aerospace engineering fields and the nuclear engineering fields, is that in aerospace, we tend to produce a whole lot of smoke, fire, and bother. Whereas in nuclear engineering, by definition, all y'all are quiet.
Well, I used to compare the excitement of our operations with some of my buddies who fly jets for a living, and kind of bemoan the fact that it would never help us sell submarining as a career field by doing things like having a submarine show. It's kind of boring. the Blue Angel equivalent just doesn't exist for us.
Yeah, I mean, it's like cruise flight. Although there was a page in I believe it was Rickover Effect, where they showed one of the it was a nuclear aircraft carrier that was going through sea trials, and they actually managed to heel her over onto her side because she had to bank through a turn because she had so much power coming out of the engines.
Well, yeah,
cavorting ships, like a speedboat.
Yeah, most ships will bank if you go fast enough. But one of the things, I'll just throw this out again. You can find some articles on my Atomic Engines website that talk about the aircraft nuclear propulsion program. And the more I read about the impacts that, you know, long-distance air travel is having on the climate and the concentration of various atmospheric contaminants other than CO2, the more I say, you know, it might be worth, might be time to go back and take a look at exactly why the aircraft nuclear propulsion program failed in the 1950s, and if anything has changed technologically since then that would cause it to be possible to at least make long-distance flight using nuclear engines. And, of course, I think the answer is yes, many things have changed, and it's certainly sure. worth a new look.
From my perspective, having been trained in aeronautical, I guess my principal concern would be weight of shielding. If there's a way of bringing the weight of the shielding down and having it so that the reactor basically behaves like an inert block under all accident conditions, and the rest of the jet can go up in flames and everything else, but the engines must remain perfectly intact.
Well, and the answer to that is I believe that there is a way to certainly make the weight, the total weight of the system, less than the weight of the fuel that has to be carried in order to do the intercontinental flights that are being done today. And when you take the fuel off, the hydrocarbon fuel, the chances of bursting into flames changes a little bit, the probability right. of flames, because then the only thing you have left to burn is upholstery.
Right. Most long-distance intercontinental aircraft lose about half their weight over the course, or 40% of their weight from where they start. I mean, a 747 starting off from New York and going to, say, Tokyo, or a super long-haul flight of, say, 8,000 miles, where the airplane can be allowed to operate in its most efficient mode because it's traveling over the pole. Those flights, they start off at weighing about 300 and some odd tons, and then they get where they're going, weighing somewhere down in the 150, 180 ton range. They burn that much up in fuel. But if you actually run out the numbers on how much fuel, if you figure up the passenger miles, it's as efficient as, in some ways, as a small car. It gets you there really fast on a reasonably small amount of fuel. And there's an awful lot of things that drive aircraft design in the way of constraints. I mean, aircraft fly as high as they can, but no higher, as fast as they can, but no faster. And there are hard physical limits in there on each one of those speeds. I mean, one of the reasons why the Concorde never really was reasonable is because it had a maximum range of 3,000 miles. In order for the Concorde to go any farther than the canonical New York to Paris or New York to London routes that was famous for through its lifetime, they actually had to stop in Portugal and refuel to go anywhere like Africa.
Well, that kind of takes away the advantage of speed, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the Concorde flew at 1,400, 1,300 miles an hour, just above Mach 2, and consumed three times the fuel. And as you go faster, unless you go into a fractional ballistic trajectory where there is no air drag because you are behaving partially like a spacecraft, you're just sitting there and snow plowing through the atmosphere faster and faster and faster. It's kind of like wave drag. And the limit, once you get going that fast, you start making waves just like boats do. And making those waves is extraordinarily expensive energy-wise.
Right. I mean, for a ship, we normally say in order to double speed, you need eight times as much power, which means four times as much fuel consumption per mile.
Yep.
Because you're going twice as fast, but using eight times as much fuel.
Plus, of course, you also have the problems of sonic booms if you're going over inhabited territory. And there's not very much that you can do other than radically change the design of your aircraft, which has been thought about to reduce the boom signature, but you're still going to rattle some dishes.
Right. So, but as I remember, when in the 1950s, when people were making the calculations with the material limits in place at the time, it still looked like they were going to be able to make a plane that weighed roughly 300,000 pounds that could fly at speeds up to about 300 knots at altitudes of perhaps 10 to 20,000 feet. That was the kind of the weight and power limits that were available. But that was with turbine inlet temperatures that were on the order of 900 degrees Fahrenheit. Because they didn't have reactor materials that could get them any hotter.
Right.
Which severely limits your power to weight ratios. But anyway, that's kind of speculation. I think it's worth talking about. I think that, frankly, most technical topics are worth discussing in a rational manner. There's
sure.
no reason to have an almost religious anti-nuclear reaction like so many people do.
Right.
And at some point down the road, I want to circle back around and talk about some of the writings of one of my least favorite anti-nukes, at least in terms of his impact on the world. And I've done a lot more reading of some of the early work of Amory Levins, particularly his article from the 1976 issue of Foreign Policy.
That was back in the days when he was pushing soft energy path, wasn't it?
He hasn't stopped pushing the soft energy path since.
He just changed the names and to protect the not so innocent, and basically has gone with the times. And what worries me is that his site, Winning the Oil Endgame, actually gets cited by many, many, many policy leaders in high levels in Washington. And these people are coming along and reading his stuff and apparently not having a calculator by their side to check numbers as they go through.
Well, I got to tell you that his computations and phrasing you can have it all is a very popular message, particularly since those who actually can do the numbers often are people who recognize that when you do the numbers, it just means that you have to burn more fossil fuels
yep.
in order to make his system work.
And what scares me is the possibility that we could get, because of a variety of factors that we've talked about, that could very well come to pass. And I think, looking at it from the same point of view as the Germans, meaning the Germans are going to go ahead with their phase out. The nuclear operators are going to continue operating, and they will quite happily turn off the spigot when they're told to, because they know that not very much longer after that, they're going to be told to turn it back on again. Oh, please, please, turn it back on again.
Right.
Because there's no way they can operate without them and come anywhere near meeting Kyoto. And as far as carbon dioxide limits go, Kyoto's pretty tame. I mean, we're just holding to carbon dioxide limits from 1990. That's not exactly an equilibrium flow of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
No. No. Well, it's about 50 minutes. We've chatted about a whole bunch of topics, but that's okay because
we specialize in stir-fried random on this podcast.
Yeah, it's an interesting world out there. It's an interesting time to be a nuclear-trained person and a nuclear or an atomic entrepreneur. And, I mean, even the Washington Post talked about a resurgence in atomic power in a Sunday's paper. So I'm not a reader necessarily of the paper all the time. I mainly get my news online, but my colleagues have heard me talking about nuclear power enough that I walk into the office on a regular basis and find clippings and whatnot and a clipping from the paper and a National Geographic magazine on my desk from, amazingly enough, April 1979. You gotta check that one out.
Hmm.
That was the same month that Three Mile Island happened, by the way.
Right. That was March, so I think they just they rushed that issue to press in order to get the Three Mile Island coverage into it, right?
Oh, I don't think that Three Mile Island was in March. I have to check that.
I remember it was at the end of March. I think it was like March 29th or 30th, and the accident conditions were being resolved in early April. But the actual incident itself, where it started off at 4 o'clock in the morning and people dealing with poor interface
design.
Yeah,
you're right. It started March 28th, 1979. Interesting. Of course, the April issue of National Geographic was already on the newsstand by that time, because they always release it a week or so early. So, anyway, you all take care.
And have a good week.
And by the way, go visit some of the other podcasts on the podcast network. There's some really good stuff going on out there. Bye.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need. Something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.